From NPR and the Futuro Media Group, it's Latino USA. I'm Maria Hinojosa. There are stereotypes about every kind of person, and Latinos and Latinas are no exception.
The señorita, kind of the virginal Latina, the spitfire, also known as the female clown, and the dark lady, which is the sort of untrustworthy vixen.
Today, how clichés like the Latina bombshell and the Latin lover can have a long-term impact on you, on me, on everyone.
Not letting young men come into their sexuality at their own speed and like kind of forcing them into it.
When it becomes negative and when it comes to stand in for all kinds of other things which lead to harmful treatment of communities of color in particular. And here we're talking about Latinos.
Plus, we meet the Mexican weather woman who's breaking the internet. All this and more coming up on Latino USA. I'm Maria Hinojosa. Stay with us. No te vayas. Here's a pretty great way to listen to Latino USA. It's called NPR One. It's an app for your phone. It's kind of like Pandora, but it's for public radio. It's full of news and podcasts, including Latino USA. Whenever you're ready to listen, NPR One has something great just for you. Find it on your app store, NPR One. Welcome to Latino USA. I'm Maria Hinojosa. There is no shortage of stereotypes when it comes to Latinos and Latinas. You've heard them, like, you know, we all like spicy food, that we're all super loud, and that we're all great dancers, which is true. No, I'm just kidding.
Spanish makes everything sound more intriguing.
Oh, no, man, you are so loco, man.
Wow. Hello, my friend. Yo quiero Taco Bell.
Señor Slowpoke, you will be good with the chili.
Your house can't launch you.
But the thing about stereotypes, both good and bad, is that they end up having a really big impact on how others see Latinos and actually on how we see ourselves. So to start our program off, two of our producers, Antonia Cerejido and Fernanda Chavarri, got into the studio and started to talk about the over-sexualized image of Latinos in general. And we're going to talk about both men and women, but they start off the conversation about men.
So, Fernanda, you and I the other day were talking about this one SNL sketch that we saw.
Mr. Daly, do you recall the events of October 3rd, 2014, the day of the encounter?
Very clearly. I replay it like a movie in my head every single day.
Basically, it's this courtroom sketch where there's a teacher who is on trial for having a relationship with a teenage boy. And he's on the stand, and they're talking about his relationship to the teacher.
The defendant, Ms. Luna, texts, "I'm with Ms. Torkelson. Come over for some private tutoring." Winky emoji face. Can you describe your response, Mr. Daly?
Yes. I responded with a gif of a cartoon bird exiting frame so fast that his feathers fly off to imply that I was happy and on my way as quickly as possible.
Okay, you know what? We'll take a short recess and then we'll resume testimony from my man.
They would not be making fun of this situation if it was the other way around. If you flip the tables and you have a male teacher taking advantage of a young female student, no one would be high-fiving each other and thinking that it was funny. This is the second time that Saturday Night Live has done this sketch, and the first one was kind of controversial, so I'm surprised they did it again.
That was a sketch, and I actually don't think that that was based on a specific case, but these teacher-student trials do play out in the media. Back in 2008, there was a white teacher in Nebraska named Kelsey Peterson who fled to Mexico with her 13-year-old student, Fernando Rodriguez. James Martin Davis, who is the teacher's lawyer, went on to Star Jones's show, and this is a clip of his conversation with Star Jones.
But you have to tell me, if he is a child, how does a child consent to go with a grown woman to go have sex?
Help well, I resent the term child. I mean, you're babyfying this kid. This kid is a Latino machismo teenager.
Wait a minute, hold on. James, wait a minute now. Excuse me, my little antenna went off, counselor. When you say he's a Latino, what?
Very machismo. I mean, he's manly.
What do you mean he's manly? If he is under 16, he is still a child according to the law.
Is there anybody in the world that has a higher sex drive than a teenage boy?
How dare you call somebody a Latino machismo as if to suggest that the young man, just because of his Hispanic background, is of some you know what? Goodbye. Get rid of him. I'm not having that. Not on a show that still bears my name. That will not happen.
Oh, that was so painful to listen to, Antonia.
Also, like, Latino machismo?
What is it?
He's a Latino, but that doesn't even make grammatical sense.
Is there another case like this?
I mean, the highest profile case of a teacher with her student is Mary Kay Letourneau, who famously married her student and now has two teenage girls with him. And he was of Filipino descent.
She told me once that she loved me for the man I am and for the man I almost am.
Even though Mary Letourneau has admitted raping him, he still insists there was no crime.
There's been significant research that shows that boys of color are perceived to be older than they really are. But there's also something else going on here when it comes to Latino boys. There's this stereotype of the Latin lover that's been around for a while. Angel Rubio Gonzalez is a middle school teacher and an adjunct assistant professor at Hunter College. And he actually has been studying this character for a while.
Yeah, historically, the Latin lover stereotype dates back to Rudolph Valentino and the sort of silent era movie films where, you know, you have this sort of dangerously but, you know, sort of also alluring male Latino character who basically is a smooth dancer, smooth talker, the sort of exotic thing that you both repudiate but also want at the same time. Then you have people like Ricardo Montalban.
I know my own needs. And what I need from an automobile, I know I get from this new Cordova.
Fernando Lamas.
I want to change, and I will. You'll see.
There's a sense of danger, but also an alluring part of it that people just kind of want to exotify. It becomes almost a criminal kind of act.
Latinos have always been hypersexualized in the media. And so to better understand how this Latin lover stereotype affects Latino boys and men, we put together a roundtable. Angel was joined by George Machado.
Born and raised New York, Harlem, Dominican. I'm an organizer and activist in New York City.
And John Guardo.
I am the office coordinator at the Futuro Media Group. I was born in Colombia in 1972 and came to the United States in 1984 and have been here ever since.
They met here in our offices in Harlem.
So a little bit about like the sexualization of like young men that I know of and heard of in like the Dominican Republic. Many of my older family members, male family members, when they were 15, 16, have had like sexual relations with women in their mid to like late 20s. It's a thing that happens regularly. It's a thing that I think is looked upon much like the situations when you have a teacher with a younger student, like, yeah, man, you did it, like good looks, that's amazing. And you have this pressure on you, I think, to be proud of those experiences and be like excited that these things happen. One of these women who's like now in her, what, like 70s is like around the neighborhood. And then like I've had aunts like point like, oh, that's the woman that like so-and-so slept with when he was 15 and taught him all like everything that he knows. He is now like the man or like the patriarch. It perpetuates the cycle of like not letting young men come into their sexuality at their own speed and like kind of forcing them into it, not giving us the space to not be this Latino lover stereotype at all, really. I don't know how y'all feel about that.
No, I mean, it rings really true with, as an educator, this rite of passage, right, that boys have into being young men. A big part of that is the conquest of women. The older the woman, the sort of the higher points you get, you could sort of say, right? And certainly, I think I see the toll that it takes on young men, especially when that's not actually achieved, right? And this sort of constant sense that, you know, I'm not yet a man. Like, I got to hurry up and get this done, like, wrap it up.
Well, I can definitely relate to the whole rite of passage thing. My friends would be like, yo, you know, you hit that, quote unquote. But because I saw that, because I was raised in I came of age in a gangster lifestyle, so to speak, I used that to determine my own experience. And, you know, remembering how my grandfather loved my grandma, I could never really accept that whole, you come of age by having sex with a girl. I felt more that a man's strength was there to protect her and be a gentleman to her. So I feel a little like I can't relate to that whole thing altogether.
One thing I do push back on what folks tell me is that it's sort of this idea that men are wired not to be able to be emotionally literate, right? And that we have to teach men to be emotionally literate. I think it's a misconception. I mean, in the research that I've done with middle school boys and the interviews I've done with them, one question I ask them is, describe the first time you met your best friend. When you read those transcripts of young boys mentioning the first time they met their best friend in middle school, it's like a romance novel. Like, they're talking about, like, I remember, you know, when he laughed the first time, and I was really drawn to the way he laughed, and it was like a puppy licking my face, right? And these are, like, young men, like, Black and Latinx boys talking about, like, these emotions, right? And I couldn't help but think, you know, what happens? Like, what happens to that, right? And I think a lot of it has little to do with biology or whatever else you want to assign to it, and more having to do with the fact that we're socialized away from that.
I have a young daughter. You know, she got pregnant out of wedlock, you know, just like a teenage pregnancy. And in trying to understand, you know, where everything went wrong, I agree with you. It's like a lot of us don't get the opportunity to become emotionally sophisticated. You know, we kind of just jump into it and we make mistakes. And by the time that we come of age, we're kind of buried under all this, for lack of a better word, like bad karma when it comes to that.
The first time I dated a woman that was white, she told me one time that I smelled like Spanish. And I was just like, what? What does that even mean? How does one smell like worse? She was really just making a blanket statement about me being Latino and like all of these ideas that she has in her head from God knows where are just projecting that on me. And like, it's like, to know that that's there and, like, honestly, having taken advantage of that at points in time in my, like, when I was younger and, like, trying to figure out how to be in the world and how to, like, be a sexual adult in the world. I'm like, yeah, I know if I'm here at this liberal arts college, predominantly with white people, like, I can play up this Dominican thing real well and, like, things can go, like, I'm gonna be okay. It was difficult to reckon with that, like, I'm using this, like, weird, insane exotification that exists about like an entire like, swath of people and like just kind of entirely objectifies myself and my sexuality and like my like heritage and the cultures I come from, and like using that like to get laid was like really hard to process after the fact. And it was so I don't know about if any of y'all have ever done that at any point in time, but yeah,
I think I definitely could have cashed in that chip. You know, I'm seeing my other gangster friends, you know, rack up girls or whatever. I want to be the one that loves them. I want to be the one that takes care of them and protects them. And I have learned, you know, how to love a woman. And in that process, I would think that I could live up to a good definition of what a Latin lover is. Not like the bad definition, which is like this guy that takes advantage of, you know, his sexual prowess or what have you.
Many thanks to Angel Rubio Gonzalez, George Machado, and our own John Guardo.
Coming up on Latino USA, from the Latin lover to the Latina bombshell, we meet the Mexican weather girl that's blowing up the internet. Stay with us. No te vayas.
Chico bien portado, un joven responsable y siempre bien vestido. Yo no sé quién ha mentido. I don't drink or
smoking into dope with I know coke. You ask me how do I do it, I cope. My only addiction has to do with a female species. I eat them raw like sushi. No me gusta enterno, mi estilo es moderno. Si me enterno, yo me enfermo. Mi apariencia es dura, vivo en la locura. No me vengan con ternuras. So please don't judge a book by its cover. There's more to being a Latin lover.
My dear listener, before we get back to our program, I want to take a minute to read you this pretty amazing note we got from a first-time donor named Ryan. He writes, I never felt Mexican enough as a kid and didn't identify with my white peers. Being gay, a little gender nonconformist, also set me apart even further. I love listening to Latino USA because you create that space between spaces, even ones that don't fit molds, like me. Wow, Ryan. Space between spaces. I'm totally going to use that one. Thank you so much. And if you can, to all the rest of you, I hope that you will join Ryan and other amazing listeners just like him. Go to latinousa.org and click on the donate button. Every single contribution really helps our independent media. So muchas gracias. And one more thing. If you can take a second, go to iTunes and rate and review Latino USA. This really helps to get us new listeners. And the comments that you write are just so inspiring. So keep them coming, and gracias.
Support for NPR comes from NPR member stations and from the Gilchrist Foundation, supporting NPR's enduring commitment to making music, arts, and culture accessible to audiences in the Midwest and across America. More information is available at thegilchristfoundation.org. And Lumber Liquidators, a proud sponsor of NPR, offering more than 400 styles, including hardwood, bamboo, laminate, and vinyl, with flooring specialists in hundreds of stores nationwide. More at lumberliquidators.com or 1-800-HARDWOOD.
Welcome back to Latino USA. I'm Maria Hinojosa. And when we left off, we were talking about the Latin lover cliche. It's one of the many ways in which Latinos are often stereotyped and often over-sexualized. But of course, it's not just Latino men who are stereotyped as sex objects, but that whole trope about spicy Latina women or Latina bombshells. Think Sofia Vergara in Modern Family. You know, curvy, ditzy, wearing a tight red dress and super high heels. We're going to go back to our producers, Fernanda Echavarri and Antonia Cerejido, and shift the conversation over to talk about the stereotypes of Latinas.
Antonia?
Yes?
Let me start by asking you, what do you think about when you think about the weather forecast?
Al Roker.
You think about Al Roker?
Yeah.
So you don't think about a tall, beautiful Latina woman with a tight, short dress wearing high heels?
No.
Maybe if you watched a little more Spanish language TV here in the U.S., or if you watched Mexican news shows or morning shows, you'd be a little more familiar with the hot weather girl phenomenon. And the most popular Mexican weather girl is 26-year-old Janet Garcia from northern Mexico, who is super famous in gossip magazine shows and websites like TMZ are talking about her looks.
Introduced you to Janet Garcia, the Mexican weather woman who's so insanely hot that she has the entire internet up to the minute on Monterrey, Mexico's 14-day extended forecast. Well, apparently...
Hola, and welcome to TMZ Weather de Mexico. Today's forecast calls for a high of 31 degrees and 100% chance of moisture in your pants. Ay,
from the news in Monterrey, Janet Garcia.
Mexico's newest numero uno weather girl.
Oh, my God.
So you get the idea. We're talking a very good-looking Mexican woman, big boobs, big butt, tiny waist in very tight dresses, and she gives the weather report for a morning show. It's kind of like the Today Show in Monterrey. She has almost 2 million followers on Instagram, more than a million likes on Facebook, 300,000 followers on Twitter, and some of her videos of her just giving you the weather on a random Tuesday have more than 3 million views on YouTube.
Fin de semana, como podemos ver, por lo pronto el día de hoy alcanzaremos la temperatura hasta los 26 grados.
All of this started about 8 months ago when someone posted one of her weather forecast videos on Reddit.
Mínima de 16, máxima de 27 grados centígrados. Vienen cambios importantes.
I recently talked with Janet on the phone, and here she is telling us basically that after the video was posted, it blew up on the internet.
Alguien lo comparte ahí, y qué es lo que pasa, que todo, ay, la mexicana, la del clima, ¿no?
We heard in the clip earlier that some people were saying some pretty objectifying things about her. I mean, did you ask her about having men say kind of gross things online about her?
I did. I asked her about the overall comments on either YouTube or any kind of social media, because she's very active at posting pretty revealing photos on her Instagram and her Facebook. And she said that she's very happy that people are leaving her nice comments, but the ones that are a little more basically crossing the line sexually, she basically blocks those people. There are also these Australian guys that are posting YouTube videos of Janet, and they have her sort of in slow motion and this back-to-back clips of her giving the weather. And every time she turns around and you can see her from the side view or from the back, they make these terrible comments about her. Janet said she didn't know these videos existed, but she doesn't care.
We are back, ladies and gents, mostly gents. Janet Garcia, weather woman, apocalypse survival motivator, and now lingerie model. I get the bloody bullet points, and that's all you need. Minima, maxima, notchy, rain, it doesn't matter. Oh, none of it matters. It's fine.
Earlier this week, though, I did play a video for you and for the other people here in our office at Latino USA, and it was a video of a segment on the show where Janet works in the mornings.
Porque hoy vamos a medir busto, cintura, cadera de Janet Garcia.
There were two men with a measuring tape, and they were taking her measurements, her chest, her waist, and her hips. And the reactions that we got in the room, I mean, all of us were like, our jaws dropped.
I mean, yeah, it's literally making her into an object that you measure. It's like treating a person like an object. You are taking her at physical value, literally.
91. 91. Vamos con la pompa.
Ahí te va a faltar.
Janet, ponte de ladito, por favor.
I have to say, I thought that when I asked her about this video, she was going to hang up on me. I mean, she's standing on set, she's not saying much, she's wearing a tight short red dress while a man puts a tape measure to her body, but she didn't hang up on me. In fact, she said that she didn't see it as a bad thing. The reason why she wanted to have herself be measured on TV was because there was a rumor going around, since she became so famous, that perhaps her waist was even smaller than Thalia. Thalia is a very, very famous Mexican singer
and
actress,
yeah.
Huge all over the world. And she's always been known since she came out in the 80s for having a very tiny waist.
I mean, this is the part where I really do feel conflicted, because on the one hand, I think that the fact that she is confident and not worried and it has high self-esteem makes it be like, oh, that's great, whatever. But I think that she is promoting an ideal of beauty that is really
unattainable.
I mean, you know.
I believe that she really, truly doesn't think that there's anything wrong with it. But what she believes when she's doing it, it's not about the intention, it's about the results and
right.
The impact that it may have
totally.
On a wider scale. That idea of the very desirable and hypersexualized Latina woman is something that we wanted to put in a larger context, so I talked with University of Illinois professor Isabel Molina Guzman.
I teach and do research on Latinos in the media and ethnicity and race and gender and sexuality.
And she says that from a historical perspective, the image of the hypersexualized Latina goes all the way back to silent film, when Mexican actresses were brought to Hollywood to play mostly three characters.
The señorita, which is obvious, kind of the virginal Latina, the spitfire, also known as the female clown, and the dark lady, which is the sort of untrustworthy vixen. I think you can certainly see how those legacies remain part of the media landscape today. You have somebody like Gina Rodriguez playing Jane the Virgin, Sofia Vergara playing a spitfire in Modern Family, and Jennifer Lopez in Shades of Blue, who could be argued is kind of a vixen stereotype in that show.
What she says is different now is that these are now more of the leading characters in the shows versus just the secondary characters.
Cool. That's some progress.
It's some progress, yes, but we're not really there yet.
The predominantly white male producers who are making these texts saw us and needed to package us for the consumption of white mainstream audiences. And that's why it continues to sell.
And that has an impact on how we view ourselves, right?
Absolutely. And how others view us, too. Isabel said that these images have an impact on basically the psyche of young Latinas growing up, who, by the way, consume media at a much higher rate than any other group of people.
Those images they see, if they don't have any kind of strong other influences in their families, can really begin to shape their sense of what is beautiful, what is successful, what is attractive. And I think that is a something that stays with us throughout our life.
I mean, we talk about this in the office all the time.
And we wanted to record one of those conversations. So you and I talked with our fellow producers, Daisy Rosario and Sekia Gibbons, and with our executive director, Maria Chaveco, about what it's like to be a Latina woman constantly seeing these images. We start out with Maria, who said for her growing up in the 70s in New York, it was all about Iris Chacon.
She was a vedette, right? So she was a dancer, like a very over-the-top burlesque type routines.
Puerto Rico's number one star, Iris Chacon. Iris?
Here I am.
Well, it's kind of hard to talk to you like this.
It's hard, yeah. But it feels nice, yeah?
Yeah.
She had a tremendous rear end.
Yeah, this is like pre-J-Lo.
J-Lo like, was probably not even, well, maybe born. Kim? Oh, yeah. No.
This is pretty... Did you relate to her?
To Iris Chacon?
Yeah.
Absolutely not. She was very scandalous. So there was really no conversation of how liberating she actually was to Latinas in general. And then, of course, there was Charo. Gucci, Gucci. Except that Iris Chacon really came across as it was her show, and she came across more in control of the image, as opposed to Charo, who came across more as not smart and sex kitten, but not in a powerful way, you know?
Yeah.
That characterization of how they bring sort of their sexy to TV, the Charo one, is more of what I remember seeing a lot when I moved to the U.S. on shows like República Deportiva, which is an Univision show. It's a sports show that my dad would watch, and there's two men hosting it or one man hosting it, and the women that are lined up behind him serve no purpose. They are not part of the show in any way other than to stand there, half naked, and smile at the camera.
Is this still a show?
This is a show that airs right now that gets taped here in the United States.
Have you ever asked your dad, like, what he thinks about these women on the shows? It might be an awkward conversation to have with father and daughter, but I'm just curious.
I've never actually asked my dad. He has heard me make comments that are not directed at him, but at the television of, like, why do we need to look at these women right now? What purpose are they serving? However, he has chosen not to engage in a conversation with me about that.
I didn't grow up watching, like, any kind of Spanish language television. And for me, like, the Latina bombshell growing up was, like, J-Lo and Shakira. Like, those were, like, the two ones that I could think of. I identified so much with them. Like, I idolized them. I loved them. Like, to me, it's, like, interesting to hear, like, for you, it was Charo and Iris Chacon, and you were like, no, I don't want to do anything with them. To me, I was like, I want to be Shakira. I want to be J-Lo. And I wonder, like, why there was that shift in relationship. The answer probably has to do with agency.
I think the agency thing really does come into play, because when I think of Iris Chacon and when I think of Shakira and J-Lo, it's actually, I literally can picture them in the same poses a lot of time. Yeah. Like, there's a lot of... Mm-hmm. Iris Chacon, like, crawling.
Absolutely.
Like, crawling like a lion at you and stuff. And, like, how, like, J-Lo's had that pose and Shakira has had that pose, like, so many times. But I think especially, obviously, by the time you get to J-Lo and Shakira, it feels very much like that is definitely their choice. And, like, J-Lo
is very much known as like also this businesswoman and things like that.
They are sort of owning their sexuality while performing, while singing, while acting, while doing their thing versus what I was talking about, watching TV and just seeing women as props.
Have you ever felt in your personal life that the Latina bombshell women as props has ever affected you on your daily life and your dating life?
When I moved to the U.S., I went to a high school that was a very white high school, and there were a lot of boys that would be like, say something sexy in Spanish, and say something nice to me in Spanish. This was just in passing or in class, and I didn't even, quote-unquote, look the part, yet it was this exoticness of like, oh, you're Mexican? You just moved here?
Yeah.
Let me have you say some things to me. It hasn't happened to me in my regular adult dating life, but thankfully.
You guys are so lucky. Like, your huh made me be like, oh, that's sweet. It hasn't happened to
you. So it's happened to you.
Oh, goodness. Like, I can't even imagine, like, when it hasn't. I'm in a relationship now, but, like, when I would date, there were so many times that I would have so many things in common with a person I was dating, but then, like, still come to find out, like, they had specifically a thing where they had only dated Latinas. So as a non-Spanish-speaking Latina, when I would get that request of, like, say something to me in Spanish.
Oh, the language.
I don't speak Spanish, right? So I have a few Spanish phrases and things I know. So I have, and I mean, I knew I was being a weirdo jerk on purpose, but I have said to someone, I just used a line from a Goya commercial. Like, I used, like, the Goya tagline.
Tiene que ser bueno.
Half being like, let's see if you even sense that I'm just saying a thing. So I'd be like, si es Goya, tiene que ser bueno.
I can't believe
Which is like,
said
if
that.
It's Goya, it's got to be good. Which is like, I always thought in my head, like, I was laughing at the moment of doing it. So I'd say it to see.
Did you ever get called out?
Oh, I mean, they never knew what I was talking about. No, they would be like, oh, that's hot. You know, and this is like either over a drink or whatever. You know, at this point, I've written this person off mentally, but this conversation is still happening. And I'd be like, cool, I'm going to throw a commercial slogan at you for, you know, beans. Yeah.
What's interesting about that is you're saying guys that you've come to find out only dated Latinas. So I'm 51 years old. I grew up in New York City. I was born in New York City. And because of the neighborhoods that I lived in, I was always the first Latina girl they had dated. And then it was like, you know, calling me mommy or mom. And I was like, or yeah, it was ick.
All the faces of me went,
yeah, there's a lot of head shaking in this room.
Well, like everything y'all are saying, like I totally relate to as a Black woman. With the whole mommy thing, my equivalent as a Black woman is that I feel like guys will say girl more, like, come here, girl. So that's like my equivalent. I'm like, I doubt you talk like this in normal life. And so
and I'm a woman now.
Yeah. And my experiences with dating, especially with white guys, them having an obsession with my butt. Even if on like some kind of like online profile, everything is just my face. They'll express interest, they'll start off being nice. And then they'll go into, so can you send me some pictures? Or they'll point out, so I noticed I didn't get to see your body. And I said, yes, that's true. The first type of picture they want to see is a picture of my butt.
The exotic factor that goes across being African-American or Latina. It's the exoticness of it.
Yeah, absolutely.
The exoticness, but still being acceptable by like white standard terms. In the sense that like, people like fetishize Beyonce, but she's light skinned and she doesn't always rock natural hair. And like all the Black women that I saw as labeled as pretty, they didn't have like my features as like darker skin, natural hair.
Right.
So it's like, yeah, exotic, but not too exotic.
And it's this fine line between being like, okay, I want to be celebrated. I want to be proud of being Latina. I want that to be something that you, whoever I'm dating, loves. But I also don't want it to be something that's why you're interested in me.
Exactly.
Fernanda, I'm so glad we had that conversation.
Me too, Antonia. Thank you for joining me. And thank you to our executive director, Maria Chaveco, and our fellow producers, Stacey Rosario and Zakia Gibbons. You're looking just a little too hard at me. Standing just a little too close to me. You're saying not quite enough to me. You're sipping just a little too slow for me. No doubt you're playing real cool, homie. Got me thinking, what is it you do for me? Tripping a little more than I should be. So let your
Coming up on Latino USA, a controversial depiction of Mexicans.
They look like Mexican farmers sleeping on a chair, that they're homeless.
Stay with us. No te vayas. Thanks for listening to Latino USA. How about if you check out a preview of NPR's newest podcast, which is called Embedded? The show chooses a story from the news and then goes deep. So learn what it's like to be in the middle of a gang war or what it's like to be a woman in the macho world of late night comedy writing. Find Embedded now at npr.org/podcasts and on the NPR One app.
La bruta pa' cotizarse conmigo enfrente, ya se hace la gata en celo contigo. Te cortaré el oído pa' tenerte en alta. Ella muere por ti, tú por mí, que matas. Tú sigue tranquila, como una paloma de esquina. Mientras ya se pasan, suben al lado mío. Yo de aquí no me voy.
Support for NPR comes from NPR member stations and from the Candida Fund, dedicated to advancing the dignity of individuals and the sustainability of communities across the U.S. and around the globe through investments in transformative leaders and ideas. Learn more at CandidaFund.org. And Vital Projects Fund, supporting the Museum of Modern Art in Manhattan. The exhibition Marcel Broters, A Retrospective, is on view. More information and tickets at MoMA.org.
Welcome back to Latino USA. I'm Maria Hinojosa, and today we're talking about stereotypes. And if you're a fan of Mexican restaurants, then you've probably seen the guy that we're going to talk about in our next story. You've seen him as a statue, or he's painted on signs. He goes by several names, oftentimes Pancho, Pepe, Pablito, but most times he's just called the Sleeping Mexican. He looks like a Mexican worker asleep against a wall or a cactus, his face covered by a huge, not sombrero, but a huge sombrero. Is he a time-honored image, or is he actually a derogatory stereotype? Reporter Nick de la Canal brings us to Charlotte, North Carolina, where the debate around the sleeping Mexican image has become pretty fierce.
Outside Hot Taco, a new Mexican restaurant in Charlotte, 7-year-old Thomas Holmes has finished his food and is climbing on one of the two statues outside the front door.
What do they look like to you?
They look like Mexican farmers sleeping on a chair, that they're homeless.
They're homeless?
Yes. Waiting for money. That's how poor they are.
To be sure, the statues aren't the most flattering depiction of Mexican laborers. They have comically large feet. Their hands are folded over little pot bellies, huge sombreros sag over their mustachioed faces, and they look a little drunk. Across the street, Giovanni Corden sits in a folding chair in the small parking lot he manages. He's been eating at Hot Taco a lot since it opened. He passes the statues every day on his way to work.
I've been a little bothered by them when I see them. It seems kind of stereotypical, if you ask me.
Corden's family comes from Guatemala.
I find them, like, that's not a very accurate portrayal of how the Mexicans are. Looks like the cartoons made in the 20s. I mean, I am not angry about it, but it's kind of like, it's kind of bothering me a little bit.
Corden might not be that upset, but another local Guatemalan named Amalia Deloney sure is.
Two men sleeping in front of a restaurant. You know, this is an old racist trope.
Deloney saw the statues after eating at Hot Taco and got so mad, she started a petition asking the restaurant to remove them. So far, she's garnered over 300 signatures and a lot of local media attention.
What we're talking about is the power of an image when it becomes negative and when it comes to stand in for all kinds of other things which lead to harmful treatment of communities of color in particular. And here we're talking about Latinos.
Deloney is not the first to call this image racist. The sleeping Mexican has drawn controversy for years in places all over the country. His image sparked protests in San Antonio when the city planned to include him in a mural. Taco Bell used him in its logo for a decade until Chicano activists pressured the company to stop. He even had a cameo on the George Lopez show when George's neighbor bought a sleeping Mexican for his lawn and later accused George of smashing it in the middle of the night.
Oh, come on. You were at my house last night. I know you saw it.
That doesn't mean anything. Maybe the statue woke up, realized it was a racist lawn ornament, and smashed itself.
But there's more than one side to the fray. Enter Rosalia Torres Weiner, an artist living in Charlotte.
In Mexico, it's not a sign of, like, Mexicans are lazy, no. This is a sign of after a good meal, you need to take a siesta and you need to take a break.
Torres Weiner grew up in Mexico, and she remembers vendors selling these ceramic figures in the outdoor marketplaces. She's puzzled by all the fuss. She thinks the hot taco statues are funny.
I just can't believe that people are using their time to talk about statues, a little figurine that is a big part of our Mexican folk art.
She actually has a suggestion for the restaurant owners.
Free tequila shots to the haters. Y que siga la fiesta.
Jokes aside, Torres Weiner has a point here. The sleeping Mexican does have a long history in Mexican folk art.
Curiously enough, the origin of the image is where it first gets into trouble.
This is Maribel Alvarez, a social scientist at the University of Arizona. She has a collection of more than 2,000 sleeping Mexicans, figurines, paintings, all sorts of things, and she's working on an upcoming book. She says it all began in the late 1800s. That's when traveling Americans first wrote about indios exhausted after a full day's work, wrapping themselves in shawls and serapes, and crouching against buildings to rest. Those images inspired Mexican artists of the 1930s. The siesta motif was drawn by Diego Rivera and later sculpted by Mardonio Magaña. At the same time, American newspapers began printing the image as a cultural stereotype.
Cartoons with a Mexican boy wearing sarape and sandals and a sombrero represented as Mexico, the entire nation.
These cartoons reduced Latin Americans to lazy ne'er-do-wells who slept the day away. Then, in the 1940s, merchants mass-produced the sleeping Mexican as souvenirs for American tourists. These kitschy collectibles became shorthand for the tequila-drinking, burro-riding, maraca-shaking Mexican caricature. But many working-class Mexicans continued to buy these figures. They didn't care what the gringos thought. To them, the statues were a nostalgic symbol of Mexico's agrarian past.
Even with Mexican immigrants to today, many have used that as a decoration in their yards, not necessarily because they are thinking it's a lazy person.
And they're shocked when Alvarez tells them about the lazy stereotype.
It's almost like, who in the world will even come up with that crazy reading of this image? I have had that being told to me by people, of course, who are working class people themselves, who get up at dawn and work really hard and bend their backs. And, you know, by the time 11 o'clock comes around, it's time to take a rest, lean against something, and just take a short siesta and come back, get back into work.
Alvarez says there's a divide among the classes. While most working class Mexicans don't see the symbol as racist, many upper-class Mexicans do. In recent years, there's been a push by some Latinos to repurpose the symbol. A few years ago, the Arizona legislature passed a controversial law that ended up shutting down Mexican-American studies classes and banning some books in Tucson high schools. One student protested by making T-shirts with the sleeping Mexican. But look closely, and you'll see the Mexican isn't dozing under his hat at all. He's actually reading one of the banned books. A similar thing is happening here in Charlotte. Rosalia Torres Weiner, the artist, has painted her own version of the sleeping Mexican. In her painting, he's in traditional dress, crouching behind a barbed wire fence. And there's another difference.
My particular painting is not taking a nap. He's dreaming. He's dreaming for an immigration reform. and he's dreaming for a better future for us immigrants in the United States.
Its meaning changes as it migrates from murals in Mexico to U.S. restaurants to the canvases of today's artists. As for the sleeping Mexicans outside Hot Taco in Charlotte, they're still there, for now. But what people see in them, well, that depends on the person.
Cuando el pescador le reza a la luna del verano y a la luna del verano. Cuando el pescador le reza.
Cuando el pescador le reza a la luna del verano y a la luna del verano. Cuando el pescador le reza.
Salen los indios diciendo, vuelvan los tiempos lejanos, vuelvan.
Thanks to Nick de la Canal for that story. Now, the history and debate around the sleeping Mexican is a pretty good example of how stereotypes aren't just imposed on Latinos, but how Latinos contribute to stereotypes about ourselves. So I'm Mexican, and when I told my extended family in Mexico that I was marrying a man from the Dominican Republic, a successful artist from the Dominican Republic, I could tell that they already had certain ideas about Dominicans, many of which were frankly untrue. So we're calling these ideas intra-Latino stereotypes. I sat down with our senior producer, Daisy Rosario, to talk about the kinds of things Latinos say about each other.
We talk about the stereotypes that Latinos have about each other in the office all the time, I think, because we are all from different backgrounds. Like, you're Mexican, my family's Puerto Rican, we've got Cuban, we've got Argentinian. Like, we've got a lot of different types. But I want to hear, before we get into it, I want to hear more about what your family said about your marriage.
Well, a lot of Mexicans really didn't know a lot about the Dominican Republic in, 25 years ago when Germán and I announced that we were going to get married. And so when I said, I'm marrying a man from the Dominican Republic, they said, ¿Cómo? Pero ellos no hablan español bien. You know, they don't speak Spanish well. And I was like, no, please don't.
Oh, no. Yeah, that's, well, you know, it's not something that we just talk about in the office. It's something that people talk about amongst each other. I wonder if you've ever seen this video. It actually was really popular last year.
What's up, guys? These are five reasons why
DR is better than PR.
You mean Puerto Ricans are better than Dominicans?
I think someone's had a little too much coquito, papa.
I think someone's been drinking a little too much Brugal.
There's only one way to settle this.
Let's do this.
So no, I missed it, sadly.
You didn't see that?
No, I didn't see it because you didn't point it out to me.
They got a lot of views. So this is a video by a comedian who goes by Juan Bago, and these are trimmed down bits. But you should check out the whole thing. We'll link to it on our website. So we put out a call to our listeners over social media, and we heard from some people. And this is from a man named Aaron, who I think is himself not Latino, but here's what he had to say.
Yeah, I grew up in a predominantly Puerto Rican and Dominican community in Bethlehem and Allentown, Pennsylvania. And I have heard stereotypes of Puerto Ricans calling Mexicans a disgrace to the Hispanic race. But as I travel the country more, I've heard negative stereotypes about Puerto Ricans, such as Mexicans saying that Puerto Ricans are nothing but light-skinned black people or they're a ghetto and adopted hip-hop culture.
Oh, terrible. Yeah. Terrible. But you know, the interesting thing, Daisy, is how do these stereotypes come to be, right? I mean,
exactly.
Where do the images all start? They start in the media, right?
Right. And the media reflects these things, these images back at us. We also heard from a woman named Marcela, and she shared a few things that she's heard over the years.
And one intra-Latino stereotype that I have heard a lot is that Puerto Rican women are aggressive, that Puerto Ricanas basically beat their boyfriends or their husbands. My dad actually got beat up by his Puerto Rican girlfriend, but I think he deserved it because he was cheating on her. But anyway...
So go ahead and beat him up.
I know.
Okay.
And that Puerto Rican men cheat on their wives. Actually, I've heard about a lot of Latino men, now that I think about it, which is really unfortunate that we have that stereotype, or that our brothers have that stereotype.
Yeah, and it's actually, it was one of those terrible stereotypes that I dealt with here in New York when I got together with my husband, which was Dominican men. They're worse than Mexicans as macho. And I was like, no, please.
Colombian women are homewreckers. I'm Colombian. But my mother has actually jokingly said that she wouldn't move back to Colombia because she's fearful that a Colombian woman would ruin her marriage, would take her husband. And she says it jokingly, but I've heard many Colombian women say it, so.
That is the stereotype, right, of the woman who's just, like, on the prowl.
Right. I mean, and it's like we've heard about it earlier in the show of kind of like the men having these things put on them and the women being, you know, kind of overly sexual and things like that. A listener named Mayra sent in a video. She's Dominican and recently moved to Ohio from New Jersey. I thought this was cute.
I have a lot of Mexicans friends here and they say I have an accent, which I know it's my Hispanic accent. And they said, no, it's not a Hispanic accent. It's a Jersey accent. So I'm learning I have a Jersey accent. I didn't know that. I grew up in Jersey thinking I had a Hispanic accent, and I still believe I do.
I think her accent is a bit of a mix. It's like she came from the DR and then she grew up in New Jersey, so she's got a little bit of both. But we have one more thought from Mayra, and you can't see her, but to set this up, you should know that Mayra has light skin and light eyes.
I am from the Dominican Republic, and I came to the U.S., to New Jersey, when I was 12 and a half. So I was assumed to be from anywhere in the world but the Dominican Republic by other Latinos. And they said I was either Colombian, Puerto Rican, from Spain. At the top of the list was Argentina. And even I got this even from fellow Dominicans. They said I didn't look Dominican enough.
But Daisy, you know what? If I had a dollar for every single time that someone has asked me, so where are you from? And I'm like, well, I'm Mexican. And they're like, you don't look Mexican. And I'm like, and what does a Mexican look like to you? And usually that makes people kind of pause and be like, oh, right. And then I have to say, Mexicans are everything. I have cousins who are blonde haired, blue eyes and look like Farrah Fawcett. So
right.
That's who we are.
Exactly. And that's true of so many Latinos in general. It really does run the gamut. And we had a lot of people who didn't send in audio, but they did write in. And I would say that was actually a really big thing. The two big things for people who really wrote in were kind of the big light skin, dark skin divide, whether depending on how the person looked, whether they were very light or very dark, them constantly being told that they didn't look Latino.
You're too light to look Latino. You're too dark to look Latino.
Right. The people getting that a lot. And the other big one was just people getting teased for not speaking Spanish, which I can relate to.
Yeah. And you know what we talk about in the office, Daisy, is that, you know, it's like if you don't speak Spanish, ¿y qué? You know, like so it is, you know, that doesn't mean that you're any less than and more than. It's just that that's part of life. And I am always telling so many Latinos, like, don't worry about it. So you don't speak Spanish. It's cool.
Yeah, I don't speak Spanish and I'm trying to learn it. But I so often have conversations where someone speaks to me in Spanish and I understand it, but I have to answer in English. But a lot of people don't bat an eye at that, and we'll have a conversation and just go about our business.
And the thing is that if we can have that conversation without judgment, it's all good. The whole thing with prejudice and stereotypes and all of that is that it always carries judgment. It's like, we don't want to judge.
Exactly. Yeah. So, you know, maybe the wisdom for today is let's stop being so harsh on each other, I guess.
I love that. Sabiduría, words of wisdom. Stop judging each other. And Latinos, don't be so hard on yourselves and each other. Lighten up. Muchas gracias, Daisy.
Thanks, Maria.
Our fearless senior producer, Daisy Rosario. That's it for today, everyone. Latino USA is produced by Daisy Rosario, Lita Hartman, Marlon Bishop, Fernanda Echavarri, Michael Simon Johnson, Antonia Cerejido, and Zakia Gibbons. Julia Shu is our production assistant. Our engineer is Cornelius McMoyler. Nadia Raymond is our music editor. Our office coordinator is John Guardo. Our show is founded at the University of Texas at Austin. I'm your host and executive producer, Maria Hinojosa. And join us again next week. And in the meantime, check us out on Facebook, Twitter, and Tumblr. And I'll see you on my Instagram. Hasta la próxima. Oh, Maria, Maria.
Latino USA is made possible in part by the John D. and Catherine T. MacArthur Foundation and the Ford Foundation, dedicated to working with visionaries on the front lines of social change worldwide.
Because you and I are not women and we didn't have that experience growing up.
We are women.
Support for NPR comes from NPR member stations and from the Pew Charitable Trusts, driven by the power of knowledge to solve today's most challenging problems at pewtrusts.org, and Cancer Treatment Centers of America, whose National Hispanic Advisory Council is devoted to educating the Hispanic community about the causes, treatment, and prevention of cancer. Learn more at cancercenter.com. This is NPR.
I'm Maria Hinojosa. Next time on Latino USA, stories of the unsung Latino heroes of rock and roll, like the guitarist behind David Bowie's Fame.
Before he threw the song away, he just left the bass and the drums. And my part.
The great Carlos Alomar and other Latinos in rock and roll. That's next time on Latino USA.